And welcome to Crime Monthly Presents Evil Uncovered, where each week we delve into the dark realities of real-life mysteries, exposing the sinister truths hidden beneath the surface. This week, we unravel three haunting cases shrouded in secrets and lies, where boundless deceit led to tragic and deadly consequences. So prepare yourself for a journey into the heart of darkness. Listener discretion is advised. Our first story begins on a gloomy night in April 1990, 100 miles outside of Oklahoma City. Three men were driving a desolate stretch of highway, the kind of place where shadows seem to stretch endlessly, the only sound the hum of the car engine. Suddenly, their headlights caught something by the side of the road. Pulling over, they found an unconscious woman surrounded by bags of food. It looked as if she'd been hit by a car while walking back to a nearby motel from a shopping trip.
We didn't know what to think. She was just lying there, not moving. We had to do something.
The woman, who would later be identified as 20-year-old exotic dancer Tonya Hughes, was rushed to the hospital where she remained in critical condition, suffering from severe head trauma. The doctors did everything they could with what little they had to go on. But when Tonya's much older husband, Clarence, finally arrived at the hospital, his behaviour raised concerns right away. He claimed he hadn't reported his wife missing when she failed to return because he'd fallen asleep. But there was something off about him. A doctor would later say,
"He didn't want anyone near his wife, and his demeanour was suspicious. We also found evidence of historic injuries on Tonya. It made us wonder if there was more to this story, if there had been abuse. But we had nothing concrete. Just a bad feeling."
Tragically, Tonya eventually died of her injuries, leaving behind a 2-year-old son named Michael. But despite the doctor's concerns about Clarence, no investigation was launched. Instead, Tonya's death was put down as a terrible hit-and-run incident, and Clarence walked out of the hospital without any scrutiny. No one could have known the truth of who that man really was, or what he had done. The first inkling something was very wrong came when Tonya's friends tracked down her mother to offer their condolences, only to be told her daughter had died 2 decades ago, when she was 18 months old. Someone had created a new identity using the name of a dead child. But who would do that? And why? The answer to that lay in a tale that would slowly reveal secrets no one could ever have imagined. To uncover the truth of what happened to Tonya on the road that night, we need to go back in time to the life of a teenager named Sharon Marshall. Sharon was a bright and popular student at Forest Park High School in Georgia. She was in the gifted program and had dreams of becoming an aerospace engineer. With a full scholarship to the Georgia Institute of Technology, her future seemed promising. But behind closed doors, Sharon's life was anything but bright. A friend would later say,
"She was always so cheerful at school, but we all knew something was wrong at home. Her father, he was just really controlling."
Sharon's mother had died when she was a little girl, leaving her in the care of her domineering father. But Warren Marshall wasn't just controlling. He was abusive. And as Sharon grew older, the abuse turned sexual. One horrifying incident stands out, as a high school friend of Sharon's recalled a night at the Marshall trailer when they were around 15.
"That evening, we were just hanging out in her room when I found some adult-looking lingerie. When I asked her about it, she told me her father had bought it for her. Suddenly, Warren burst into the room with a gun. He forced me to the floor, put a pillow over my face, and then he raped Sharon right in front of me."
Sharon's friend was left traumatized, but Sharon begged her not to say anything, telling her,
"Daddy's just like that. Please let it go."
Sharon's only hope was to escape to college, but at 18, she got pregnant. She planned to run away to Alabama with her boyfriend, but one day in 1986, she vanished, leaving behind a note saying she'd left with her father. Her friends and boyfriend never heard from her again, and the fate of her unborn child remained a mystery. Fast forward to 1989, and Tonya and Clarence Hughes arrive in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tonya started working at a local strip club, where she quickly made friends. But Clarence was a different story. He was brutish and domineering, and Tonya often appeared with bruises. She confided in a friend that she was afraid of her husband. She knew he had taken out a life insurance policy on her and feared he was planning something sinister.
I told her to leave him, but she said she couldn't. She was scared for her life and her son's life. Clarence claimed to have connections in law enforcement and said he would find her no matter where she went.
But Clarence's obsession wasn't limited to Tonya. He'd also become fixated on another dancer at the club, 18-year-old Cheryl Ann Comesso. Cheryl had dreams of becoming a Playboy model, and Clarence promised to help her. He took photos and videos of her, but when she refused to sleep with him, he turned violent. One night, after a particularly vicious argument in the club car park in which Clarence punched her in the face, Cheryl left town. Shortly afterwards, Tonya and Clarence's trailer burned down, and they too disappeared. Not much is known about what happened to the family next, until that night in April 1990, when Tonya was found dying by the side of the road. But after her death, Clarence set off a chain of events no one could have predicted when he placed their son Michael into foster care. The little boy, just 2 years old, was left to navigate a new world without his mother. Michael's foster parents were deeply concerned about him, as he seemed to have behavioural issues, but he thrived with them, and in 1994, they set about adopting him. But the adoption process required a DNA test to confirm Clarence's paternity. The results were shocking.
We found out Clarence was not Michael's biological father. We had no idea who his real father was, but we loved him like our own.
Clarence, however, was not prepared to let Michael go. On September the 12th that year, he stormed into Michael's school in Choctaw, Oklahoma, armed with a gun, and forced the school principal to take him to Michael's classroom. Clarence grabbed Michael and marched both the boy and the principal out of the school. The scene was chaotic as Clarence's truck sped away, leaving behind a trail of dust and a community in shock. The principal was later found handcuffed to a tree in Woodland, and as the FBI launched a full-scale search for the child, they uncovered a bombshell. Clarence Hughes was not who he claimed to be. His real name was Franklin Floyd, a man with a dark and violent past. Floyd had a criminal record that included the abduction and rape of a 4-year-old girl in 1962 and a bank robbery in 1963. He had been on the run for 17 years.
We knew we were dealing with a dangerous individual. His history of violence made us fear for Michael's safety.
The search for Michael continued, but the trail was stone cold. Floyd had vanished, taking with him the answers to many haunting questions. The community held its breath, hoping for a miracle, but fearing the worst.
We just wanted Michael to be safe. We prayed every day for his return.
As the investigation deepened and Floyd's violent history was unearthed, the police began to suspect he might have been involved in Tonya's death. The darkness surrounding the case deepened when news outlets began putting Tonya's picture on screens nationwide. The truth that was revealed when a woman called in a tip was more horrifying than anyone could have imagined.
Soon as I saw the picture on the news, I realized Tonya was the girl I knew as Sharon Marshall. And back then, her husband Clarence had been her father Warren.
It was almost impossible to believe that Floyd could have married his own daughter. But when police realized he would have been in prison when Sharon was born and couldn't possibly be her father, another horrifying truth dawned. They were hunting for a man who'd gone on the run after snatching a child who wasn't his. Had he done it before? Following Michael's abduction, police had put out alerts for all of Floyd's known aliases, and they got lucky 2 months later when he applied for a driver's license in Kentucky. An officer posed as a postman to deliver it, arresting Floyd as they handed it over. However, no one in his apartment building had ever seen Michael, and Floyd refused to say where the boy was, even when he was convicted of kidnap and sentenced to 52 years behind bars. For the next 2 decades, the authorities would have no idea what happened to the little boy. It wasn't until 2014 that Floyd finally made his chilling confession to the FBI, saying coldly,
"I killed him the day I took him. Shot him twice in the back of the head."
Floyd's confessions didn't end there, and he began to unravel a story that spanned decades.
1974, I met a woman named Sandra Brandenburg at a truck stop in North Carolina. She had these 4 kids, Suzanne, Allison, Amy, and Philip. We got married in a month and headed to Dallas, Texas. Then a year later, Sandra gets herself picked up for passing bad checks.
Sandra was jailed for 30 days, but when she returned home, she found it empty. Floyd and all her children were gone. Terrified, she managed to trace 4-year-old Allison and 3-year-old Amy to a local social services agency, but 6-year-old Suzanne and 1-year-old Philip were gone. Tragically, the authorities refused to file kidnap charges, as Floyd was their legal stepfather. Philip would remain missing until 2019, when a 45-year-old man contacted authorities saying he believed he was the stolen child, and DNA results confirmed it. Floyd had given Philip away for private adoption immediately after snatching him, and he had grown up knowing nothing of his biological family. Suzanne, however, was held by Floyd from that day on, with Floyd becoming Warren Marshall and raising Suzanne as his daughter Sharon. But when she got pregnant in 1986 and wanted to run away with her boyfriend, he relocated them to Tampa, Florida, and put the baby up for adoption. Over the next few years, they moved around before arriving in Tulsa in 1989. By that time, they were married and living as Clarence and Tonya Hughes. While Clarence got obsessed with Tonya's fellow dancer, Cheryl Ann, Tonya began a relationship with a college student, and in April 1990, they planned to run away together with little Michael. Shortly after that, police believe Floyd killed her in that hit and run. It was a tragic end to a devastatingly sad life, and there would be one more twist to the tale. In 1995, a mechanic found an envelope hidden in a truck he bought at auction. Inside were 97 photographs. Many showed sexual images of Suzanne, starting from the age of around 5, but among the photos were images of a second young woman, bound and brutally beaten. An FBI agent would later say,
"When we saw those photos, we knew we were dealing with something sinister. The brutality was unmistakable."
Tracing the truck's ownership back to Floyd, the FBI sent the images to various states, hoping for a match. The breakthrough came when the skeletal remains of a woman were discovered near a highway in Florida and identified as Cheryl Ann Comesso. The photographs led to Floyd being convicted of first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to death. On January the 23rd, 2023, Floyd died from natural causes while on death row, age 79.
Floyd's ability to evade capture for so long was a testament to his cunning and ruthlessness. But in the end, justice caught up with him.
The tale of Franklin Floyd is a chilling reminder of the darkness that can lurk behind a seemingly ordinary facade. His crimes spanned decades, leaving scars on countless lives, and as we close this tale, we are left to ponder the depths of human depravity and the resilience of those who seek justice. Our second story sees us traveling to Colorado, and the case of Dylan Redwine, a teenage boy whose life was cut short under mysterious and horrifying circumstances.
Hey, good evening, folks. This is the captain speaking. Welcome on flight 9.
In November 2012, 13-year-old Dylan found himself on a plane to Colorado. It was a court-ordered visit to see his father, 60-year-old Mark Redwine, following his parents' separation. The relationship between father and son had been strained for some time, and this visit was anything but a joyous reunion. The tension between Dylan and his father had roots that ran deep. A year earlier, in 2011, Dylan and his older half-brother Corey had made a disturbing discovery while playing with their father's computer. What they found would forever change their perception of their father. Corey said,
"We were just messing around on Dad's laptop, you know, like kids do. And then we saw them, photos of him, doing things no one should ever see."
The images were shocking. Mark Redwine was depicted engaging in a depraved act, eating from a soiled nappy. This horrifying discovery was something the boys kept to themselves, although Corey took pictures on his phone to keep as evidence if it was ever needed. But it deeply affected Dylan, and the bond between father and son was irreparably damaged. Despite his reluctance, Dylan boarded the plane to visit his father for the Thanksgiving holiday. For his mother, Elaine Hall, it was a moment filled with dread.
He didn't want to go. He was so upset about it. But what could we do? The court said he had to go.
Mark picked Dylan up from the airport, and they headed to his home. The following morning, Mark claimed he left the house to run some errands. When he returned, Dylan was nowhere to be found. A bowl of cereal sat on the table, and the TV was on a kids' channel. But there was no sign of Dylan. Panic set in quickly. Mark reported his son missing, and a massive manhunt ensued. The community and law enforcement scoured the surrounding mountainous areas, but there was no trace of Dylan. However, the investigation into Dylan's disappearance would soon reveal more than anyone could have anticipated. A forensic search of Mark's home uncovered Dylan's blood in multiple areas. The sofa, the coffee table, the floor beneath a rug, and another chair. Even more damning was the sniffer dog's detection of human remains near the washing machine, in Mark's pickup truck, and on the clothes he wore the day Dylan vanished. But without a body, the mystery of what happened to Dylan would remain unsolved, and his father would remain a free man. It wasn't until June 2013, 7 months after Dylan's disappearance, that his partial remains were found just a few miles from Mark's home. And 2 years later, hikers discovered his skull a mile away from the initial site. Forensic experts testified,
"The skull showed clear signs of blunt force trauma. There were also two small markings that appeared to have been made by a knife."
The discovery of these remains only deepened the suspicion surrounding Mark Redwine. The once tense relationship between father and son had culminated in a tragedy that no one could have foreseen. The local community was left in shock, and the search for justice had only just begun. Throughout the years, Dylan's mother, Elaine, had been vocal about her suspicions. She consistently accused her ex-husband of harming their son, citing past threats Mark had made during their contentious divorce and custody battle.
"Mark had always been volatile. During our divorce, he said he would kill the kids before letting me have them. I knew in my heart he was capable of this."
On national television during an appearance on the show Dr. Phil, the tension between them was palpable when Elaine confronted Mark, accusing him of knowing more than he was letting on.
"I really have a concern that you hurt him and his bones are out there just laying and you don't even care. Did you hurt him?"
"No, Elaine, I wouldn't hurt him. What kind of mother are you to even think that I was capable of doing something like that?"
Despite Mark's denials, Elaine was convinced Mark had harmed Dylan and revealed he'd once told her that if he ever had to get rid of a body, he'd leave it in the mountains near his home. Frustrated with the lack of progress in criminal charges against Mark, Elaine filed a wrongful death suit against him in 2015. It was a bold move, but Elaine was determined to hold Mark accountable. The discovery of Dylan's remains marked a turning point in the investigation. It provided the evidence needed to push forward, but the journey to justice was far from over. After a grueling 5-year investigation, the long arm of the law finally caught up with Mark Redwine. In 2017, he was arrested and charged with second-degree murder. The trial that followed was nothing short of explosive. The courtroom was a battleground of emotions and revelations. Corey, Mark's older son, took the stand and delivered a testimony that would become a pivotal moment in the case.
"We found those poop photos on Dad's computer. Dylan was disgusted. He said he wanted to use them as leverage in an argument with Dad."
The prosecution argued that Mark killed Dylan after a confrontation about the fetish photos. The evidence was damning, and the judge did not mince his words when he addressed Mark. His voice echoed through the courtroom, condemning the heinous actions.
"First of all, you killed your son, a 13-year-old boy. At 13, he's still a little boy. As the father, it's your obligation to protect your son, keep him from harm. Instead of that, you inflicted enough injury on him to kill him in your living room.
The judge's words cut through the tension like a knife as he continued, this time highlighting Mark's attempts to cover up his crime.
After the passion of whatever caused you to act the way you did subsided, you didn't think about Dylan. You thought about yourself. You sanitized the crime scene. You hid Dylan's body. And you went so far as to remove his head from the rest of his body.
The courtroom fell silent, the weight of the judge's words hanging heavily in the air. Mark's lack of remorse was palpable, and the judge made it clear that society needed protection from him.
I have trouble remembering a convicted criminal defendant that has shown such a lack of remorse for his behavior. The community needs to be protected from you. You need to be removed from society for a very long period of time.
After a 5-week trial, Mark Redwine was convicted of second-degree murder and child abuse, resulting in the death of his son. The prosecution's plea for the maximum penalty was granted, and Mark was sentenced to 48 years behind bars. For Dylan's mother, Elaine, the verdict was a bittersweet moment. She had fought tirelessly for justice, and now she finally had some semblance of it.
It's justice as far as justice can go. There will never be enough time for taking Dylan's life. But at least he hopefully won't get out. Hopefully, he'll die in prison.
The aftermath of the sentencing left a community grappling with the horror of what had transpired. The judge's emphasis on Mark's lack of remorse was a stark reminder of the cold-blooded nature of the crime. The sentence could never bring Dylan back, but it was a step towards healing for those who loved him. The community, scarred but resilient, began the long process of moving forward, forever changed by the tragedy that had unfolded in their midst.
Crime Monthly magazine is dedicated to all things true crime, where you'll find all the latest news, in-depth features, interviews with leading experts, and so much more. We've even got your essential entertainment guide for the month ahead. Buy in all good shops and supermarkets or subscribe now at greatmagazines.co.uk.
As we leave Colorado, we head across the country to New Hampshire. This was the site of a chilling and complex case that would come to be known as the Bear Brook Murders, a mystery that began with the discovery of 4 bodies in 2 barrels and would end with the unmasking of a notorious serial killer. On November the 10th, 1985, on a crisp autumn day in Allenstown, New Hampshire, 3 boys were playing hide-and-seek in Bear Brook State Park. Sprawling over 10,000 acres, it was a familiar playground for the kids who lived in a nearby trailer park. As they darted through the woods, one of the boys stumbled upon a rusting blue steel drum. Their youthful curiosity ignited. They pried it open only to be hit by a putrid smell. One of the boys kicked the drum, and a white liquid poured out. Thinking it was just rotten milk, they left it alone and went home, unaware of the dreadful secret within. Months passed, and the drum sat undisturbed until a hunter, trekking through the same woods, came across the rancid-smelling barrel. This time, as suspicion took hold, the hunter peered inside and saw what he believed to be human bones. Alarmed, he called the police. When investigators arrived and fully opened the drum, they were met with a gruesome discovery.
Inside were the decomposed bodies of a young woman and a girl, both naked and bound with electrical wire. The victims had been killed by blunt force trauma to the head. The bodies were in an advanced state of decomposition. It was clear they had been there for years.
The skeletal remains were identified as a woman in her 20s and a girl of around 8 to 10 years old. But despite extensive efforts, including dental record checks, school inquiries, and artist sketches, the victims remained unidentified. Law enforcement swept the area for clues, but the investigation hit a dead end. The local community, moved by the tragedy, took the unknown victims to their hearts, and when the remains were released, they buried them with a headstone that read,
"Here lies the mortal remains known only to God of a woman aged 23 to 33 and a girl child aged 8 to 10. Their slain bodies were found on the 10th of November, 1985, in Bear Brook State Park. May their souls rest in peace in God's loving care."
The townsfolk tended the graves, laying flowers and soft toys, a poignant reminder of the lives lost and the mystery that remained unsolved. Little did they know, this was just the beginning of a twisted tale that would go on to span decades. Fifteen years passed after that grim discovery in Bearbrook State Park. The case went cold. The victims' identities remained a mystery, and the killer was still at large. But in 2000, a determined police officer decided to reopen the case, hoping that advancements in technology might shed new light on the secrets hidden in the woods. And as the officer meticulously combed through the area near the original crime scene, he stumbled upon something that would reignite the investigation. A second barrel, rusting and weathered, just 100 yards from where the first had been found. Horrifyingly, inside this barrel were the bodies of two little girls, a discovery that was both shocking and heartbreaking. The skeletal remains were carefully extracted and sent for DNA testing, and the results were astonishing. The woman found in the first barrel all those years ago was not only the mother of the girl she had been found with, but also of one of the little girls in this second barrel. However, the other child in the barrel, who was around 4 or 5 years old, was not related to any of them.
The DNA tests were a breakthrough. We now knew that the victims were connected, but their identities still eluded us. Despite the advanced technology and renewed efforts, we were no closer to knowing who they were.
The renewed investigation was exhaustive, and law enforcement utilized every tool at their disposal. Three-dimensional models of the victims' faces were created, and their hair was analyzed to determine their geographical origins. Yet, as every lead seemed to hit a dead end, the frustration was palpable, and the community once again was left with more questions than answers. Who were these children? Why had they been killed? And who was responsible?
It was devastating. We thought we might finally get some answers, but it felt like we were back at square one.
Despite the setbacks, the discovery of the second barrel marked a pivotal moment in the case. It was a reminder that the past could not be buried forever, and that the truth, no matter how deeply hidden, would eventually come to light. The investigation was far from over, and the secrets of Bearbrook were still waiting to be uncovered. In 1999, chemist Yeon Sun-jun, a woman who had always felt like an outsider, found herself falling in love. At the age of 42, she met Larry Vanner, a man who seemed to offer her the companionship she had longed for. They married in 2001, but the relationship quickly took a terrible turn. The rude and intimidating Vanner began to isolate Yeon Sun from her family. The once vibrant connections she had with her loved ones dwindled until they were almost non-existent. In 2002, Yeon Sun was reported missing and her family, desperate for answers, turned to the police. When officers interviewed Vanner, they immediately sensed something was wrong, and his evasive answers and nervous demeanor raised red flags. They decided to run his fingerprints, hoping to uncover more about the man who had so suddenly entered Yeon Sun's life. And the results were shocking. Vanner had multiple aliases, including Curtis Kimball, a name linked to a prior conviction. This revelation prompted the police to obtain a warrant to search his property. There, in the dim light of Vanner's basement, officers made a gruesome discovery. Yeon Sun's body lay buried under a mound of cat litter, a crude attempt to mask the smell of decomposition. She had been killed by blunt force trauma to the head. Determined to build a solid case, a detective traced Vanner's steps. She contacted every pet store in the area until she found one where an employee remembered Vanner.
He bought so much cat litter, it seemed odd. But he said it was for an oil spill, so we didn't think much of it.
Confronted with the evidence and to their surprise, Vanner immediately confessed to murder. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 15 years in prison. But the detective had a nagging suspicion that Vanner's confession was a strategic move to prevent further investigation into his past. The fingerprints had revealed a tangled web of identities, and the name Curtis Kimball led to a disturbing history. His dark past was beginning to unravel, hinting at secrets that stretched far beyond the confines of his basement. Years earlier, a man named Gordon Jensen had been living in a Californian trailer park, accompanied by his young daughter Lisa. Their elderly neighbours, Richard and Catherine Decker, grew fond of Lisa, but they couldn't ignore the signs of neglect. She was thin, unkempt, and could often be heard crying at night. Jensen confided in the Deckers that his wife had died, and he was struggling as a single parent. When he expressed a desire to find a new home for Lisa, the Deckers suggested a trial adoption with their daughter, who longed for a little girl of her own.
Lisa was such a sweet child, but she had been through so much. We wanted to give her a safe and loving home.
However, while Lisa was temporarily staying with the Deckers, she exhibited behavior that indicated she had been sexually abused. The family urgently wanted Jensen to sign the adoption papers so they could get the vulnerable young girl away from him. But one night, he vanished without a trace, leaving Lisa behind. There was no choice but to have the little girl taken into care, and Jensen was now a wanted man. But there were more shocks to come, as when police checked the fingerprints in Jensen's trailer, they discovered he was in fact Curtis Kimball. Kimball would go on to evade capture for 2 years until he was arrested on a driving offence. When his fingerprints linked him back to Lisa, he was charged with molesting and abandoning her. In a plea deal, the sexual abuse charge was dropped, and he served 18 months in prison for child abandonment. But there was a further stunning revelation to come. DNA tests revealed that not only was Kimball not Lisa's biological father, but Lisa was actually Dawn Bodin, who had gone missing with her mother Denise in 1981. The revelation of Lisa's true identity only deepened the mystery. What had happened to Denise? And how had Dawn ended up in the care of a man with so many aliases? Dawn was 22 years old when she discovered her true identity. She would go on to marry and have 3 children of her own, but the fate of her mother remained an unsolved mystery. She said,
"I owe everything to the Deckers. Without them, I don't know where I would be today. But I still wonder about my mom and what could have happened to her."
As investigators finally unraveled the tangled web of identities, they realized Vanna, Jensen, and Kimball were all the same man, and his real name was Terry Rasmussen. And as they traced a timeline of his life, they would edge ever closer to solving one of their most painful and enduring mysteries. Born in 1943, Rasmussen's life was marred by a history of heavy drinking. He joined the Navy as a teenager, married young, and had 4 children. But his violent behavior and drinking habits tore his family apart. After being thrown out by his first wife, he became a drifter, wandering across America, working and living in trailer parks. In the early 1980s, Rasmussen had found himself in Allenstown, New Hampshire. As soon as law enforcement realized he had been in that area at that time, they began to ask if he could have had anything to do with the bodies found in Bear Brook State Park. The adult woman and 3 children left in those barrels had suffered the same fate as Rasmussen's other known victims: blunt force trauma to the head, with their bodies bound with electrical wire. And Rasmussen was known to be working as an electrician at the time.
When we connected Rasmussen to the Bear Brook murders, it was a breakthrough. His presence in Allenstown during the early 1980s raised suspicions, and then DNA evidence confirmed our worst fears.
Suspecting that the adult woman victim may have been Dawn Bodin, they ran DNA tests. It wasn't, but they did discover that Rasmussen was the father of the 4th victim in the barrels, connecting him to the murders. So in June 2017, they gave a press conference revealing Rasmussen was the killer they had been hunting all these years.
Unmasking Rasmussen was like piecing together a dark, twisted puzzle. Each revelation brought us closer to understanding the full scope of his atrocities. He was a chameleon, constantly changing his identity to evade capture.
Rasmussen was already dead by the time police pieced together this part of the story. He succumbed to lung cancer and pneumonia in prison on December the 28th, 2010, aged 67. His death left behind a trail of unanswered questions, but in 2018 there was to be one last breakthrough. a research librarian, driven by a passion for solving cold cases, was assisting a woman in the search for her half-sister, Sarah, who had vanished along with her mother and sister in 1978. It was her research that would lead to a poignant discovery.
I couldn't believe it at first. The dates, the ages, everything matched. I knew I had to go to the police with this information.
In an emotional press conference held in June 2019, the police were finally able to reveal the identities of the victims found in the barrels. They were named as Marlies Honeychurch and her daughters Marie and Sarah.
The community, which had cared for the graves of the unknown victims for so many years, now had names to honor.
Only one mystery remained unsolved. The identity of the fourth child, Rasmussen's own daughter, still eluded investigators. Despite extensive efforts, her name and story remain unknown, a haunting reminder of the many secrets Rasmussen took to his grave. And as we close this chapter, we are left with the unsettling thought that there may be more barrels and more victims waiting to be discovered in the woods. That's all from this week's episode. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to tune in next time when we'll be bringing you three more tales of true life terror. Evil Uncovered is brought to you by Bauer Media. Concept and original stories by Steph Seelan and Lisa Howells. Episode written and exec produced by Lisa Howells. Produced and edited by Rick Simmons. AI voices produced and edited by Waldemar Matwash. Episode created with support from WeDaVinci AI Technology.